The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 319 for Monday, March 7th, 2011.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you, the listeners, help make the agenda. You send in your questions, your tips, your comments. We do our best to research them, answer them, relay them, and anything that we can to help you learn more about your Mac and other Apple devices here in Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
And there, I mean here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
And for the next hour or so, we will both be here in your ears or your speakers or wherever it is that your travels bring us with you. How you doing today, John? Things going well?
I'm doing great. We're, I'm not going to talk about the weather and how all the snow washed away. Oh, no, it did.
Oh, that's good.
So I think spring has sprung. I think it's going to spring soon.
Yeah, we lost a bunch of our ice, but we still got probably, 6-8 inches of snow left, but that has yet to melt.
Yeah. Yeah. I saw that picture of your driveway and you're lamenting the ice flows, reduced real estate.
That's right. That's right.
All right.
So, let's dive in and go with Rick here because we have a lot to go through. I have no doubt we won't make it all the way through our agenda, but that is okay. So Rick wrote, until last Thursday, my iPhone 3G synced to my Mac Pro faultlessly. Since then, however, it will not even show up in iTunes and I'm running 10.1.2. This came in before the 10.2 update was released. I have fixed permissions. I have run Disk Warrior. I've tried other iTunes libraries. I even tried a different clean user account. All didn't help. I have put my iPhone on other Macs and it does show up fine. While I could possibly move to a different machine, I would rather not. He also followed up and said that he's able to sync to his old iPod just fine. So I did some research, John, and I found Apple has a knowledge base article, and I'm going to mention two. So we'll link to both of them. TS1591 that talks about all the various troubleshooting options, including reinstalling iTunes, many of the things that he tried. And then at the very end, John, it refers to another knowledge base article titled or talking about reinstalling the Apple mobile device service. Apparently, this is a service that affects iTunes from seeing the iPhone, the iPad, the iPod Touch, and the 5G iPod Nano. So all devices that are running iOS as opposed to older iPods, which ran, whatever it is that they run. So and we'll put the link out because there's no reason to have to remember it. But the process involves deleting iTunes and then deleting a text file in the system library extensions folder. And also digging into the package receipts and deleting one for Apple mobile device support and then reinstalling iTunes, which presumably will see that those two are missing and repopulate it. But very, very interesting to see that. I never even realized this was out there. So any thoughts on this, John?
That's really getting kind of deep, especially a kernel extension. That surprises me.
I know.
The only thing that occurs to me is, and one thing that I find is always helpful to diagnose or try to pinpoint problems with peripherals is my pal Hardware Growler.
Oh, right.
Which I think it's a good general purpose tool because when I plug in any device, whether it be USB or FireWire, or even a network device, you'll get a little notification showing the steps that the computer is taking to recognize it. And, one of the first ones I'll see, it says, oh, USB, look, I see something called an iPhone, and then it'll continue with that. So that's the only thought. Other than that, nice work, but wow, that you have to muck around at that level is kind of disturbs me.
It does. Yeah. So the other thing would be to look in System Profiler, right, and make sure that the iPhone is showing up as a USB device. I would presume even if the mobile, the mobile device service is not launched, that it would at the very least show up as a USB device. So you can know that, the machine's seeing it. But of course, testing it on another Mac ensures that the device is working. So, very, very interesting. that that even existed. I had no idea. So good advice to share. Moving on to Gearhard. Gearhard writes, this gets very interesting. Okay. He says, a few days ago, my Mac Pro developed a serious fault. I cannot eject any disk images or USB drives without doing a reboot. I ran maintenance scripts. I repaired permissions. I cleared the PRAM. Nothing. We've had a little bit of an email back and forth with Gearhard, and he said the error message that he was seeing was that the disk was in use. And he, again, tried, you know, forced option ejecting from disk utility, various tools, and no luck. So the next question, if it says it's in use, the next question is to figure out exactly how or what we're using, what's using it, right? And my the only real way I know how to do this, John, and maybe you know another way, maybe you don't, is to use a terminal command called LSOF. And we've talked about this before, but I want to talk about exactly how to use it. And we'll probably run a little article on TMO on this because some of this terminal stuff is easier to see when you look at it. But the idea is if you run LSOF from the terminal, it will show you all the open files. Now, that's not entirely helpful because that's a lot of stuff. So you can do one of two things. You want to search through that list of open files for the name of the drive that you're trying to eject. And so I use the grep command. I say LSOF and space pipe grep and send it out there. But you can also just use terminal's find command. And it will show you the name of the program. And it might be some background process, Gearhard, but something out there is running and saving files or keeping files open on that device. I'd sure be curious to know what it is, because that's a strange one that it's going and doing it to every single device. Yeah. Do you have anything on that, John?
Absolutely.
Good.
I'm going to surprise you. It's a good surprise.
Go.
So one thing you may want to try, now it's not a default option, but we recently talked about this really slick utility called FS Eventer,
right?
That draws in the ability of something called FS Events in Mac OS X, which in a nutshell are file system events that will tell you if something in a particular directory has changed. But there's a checkbox in FS Eventer that's normally not checked. So you may want to try this as well, as get FS Eventer. And it's listed under experimental, but I found it works. And it's a checkbox saying list of all open files. And I think it's doing
same thing,
pretty much what LSOF is doing. But sure, it shows it in a nice, happy graphical format. You know, so it's going to show you everything, and you may get a hint of you know, who is causing the problem here. Now, the other thing I noticed, Dave, though, I don't know if Gearhard, hope I got that right, is running the latest version of Mac OS X here. He wasn't specific. And, you know, whenever you get in touch with us, the more specific you can give us, the better. But I tried this, Dave. I tried opening some files on either USB or network attached disks and then tried to eject them.
Yep.
And what I got was a dialogue. For example, I'm going to read you. It's very short and I don't think it'll put you to sleep. But when I tried this with a file that I knew was open on the volume, I got the following error message. The disk Macintosh HD couldn't be ejected because QuickTime Player is using it.
That's perfect. That's kind of what you're looking for, isn't it?
And it says, quit the application and try to eject the disk again. And a little okay. What's doing this, you ask?
What's doing this, John?
And I found this out. So there's something, that's why I'm wondering if he's not running the latest OS. And I found what is doing this for you. If you go to System, Library, Core Services, there's a little ditty in there called Unmount Assistant Agent, which is what's throwing up that message. Because actually I found that out because I did a screenshot of it and using Snaps Pro 10. And it typically titles, or one mode is that the title of the snapshot will be the process that you're taking, you're in when you're taking a picture of it.
Right.
So I'm wondering if that service is either not there because he may not be running the latest version of OS X, or it's damaged or missing. So I guess I'm scratching my head, because from what I've seen, the OS should be smart enough to give you the exact message that I told you here, which is identifying the application
right,
that's holding on to the file that's preventing it from being ejected, which is a good thing. So I don't know why that didn't come up.
Well, you know, I have seen situations where that doesn't come up. And I think when it doesn't, I think it only comes up for apps that are like foreground apps, right? Okay. Like QuickTime, you know, that sort of thing. I don't think that process triggers when it's held in place by a background app. I could be wrong, but that's what I seem to remember. So,
okay. No, that makes sense. Cause I tried with a couple and I just did it quickly with movie files and it was either QuickTime player or FLV or so yeah. So it could be a, you know, some daemon or something that,
right.
Yeah. So it only operates at a higher level perhaps, but right. Yeah. See if you got that in the location we mentioned.
Yeah. It's fascinating.
Maybe reapply, you want to reapply a recent, you know, like you suggest, you know, a recent system update, maybe that file isn't there for whatever reason, or it's damaged or.
Yeah. Interesting.
And then you'll get that info. And so, all right.
So we have an interesting question from Mark about how to use filters to divide up email. And we'll play that in a minute. But first, I want to talk about our first sponsor for this show, which is Circus Ponies with Notebook. Notebook is available for both the Mac and the iPad. And the idea behind Notebook is that you use it to store data about a particular project or a class you're taking, maybe. When you launch it, you get the familiar white line notebook view, and you can type right into it with your keyboard, of course, and tab in and do an outline kind of hierarchy list. You can create multiple pages. And you can store different things on the different pages inside there. But the cool part comes when you can start pulling things in, like PDFs or pictures or even audio files. You could record the lecture for a class that you go to and take your notes right there. And then that way you've got the recording if you have to go back and you want to check it. It will then sync back and forth with the iPad. So you can take notes or otherwise edit your notebooks on the iPad and sync it back and forth with your Mac. Notebook is, of course, from Circus Ponies at circusponies.com. The iPad version is $29.99. The Mac version is $49.95 and comes with the ability to get a cheaper version for $20 via an academic license if you're a student or teacher at pretty much any qualifying school, including K-12 as well as beyond. There is a 30-day free trial for the Mac version that you can get from circusponies.com. And the iPad version, of course, is found in the Mac App Store, but you can find in the iTunes App Store. You can find information, of course, at circusponies.com. All right, John. And now it's time to hear from Mark.
Hey, John and Dave. Mark from Temecula, California. After my day job, I'm the president of a nonprofit parent volunteer organization. And at the first of the month, when we send out our invoices, we get slammed with emails from our members who have questions about what they're seeing on their invoices. So much email, it's too much for one volunteer parent to handle. However, it's not too much for two parents to handle if we could split the load up a little bit. I'm wondering if you guys know of a way to take, maybe some mail rule or some app, something off the shelf where I could take, an email that comes into an IMAP or POP account. And when it's the first email, it goes one direction. When it's the second email, it goes in another direction. And the third email, well, that goes back to the first person. And then that way we can have two parent volunteers each getting, just a half of the email load that's coming in on this. Or even if I could take all the emails that come in between midnight and noon and send that to one volunteer, and all those emails from noon to midnight and send it to another volunteer, that would be helpful. If you can think of some, I'd just love to know how you would skin this cat, short of writing some involved PHP script and cron job. Let me know what you guys, how you guys would handle this. Here's where you cut me off.
And so we shall. All right, John, let's pass this one back and forth, but you go ahead. You start.
I'm going to start because I think I got it.
All right.
And I ran into this recently. So a mail rule should do this for you, but not the default list of conditions that you get in mail. So I looked at the mail rules. You know, I built a few that they will, key on certain information in the header of the email.
Yep.
To put in a certain mailbox, which is how I organize things.
Sure.
For example, if things are sent to John at MacObserver.com, I put them in the Mac Observer folder.
Okay.
Or mailbox. So I looked at the rule list, and I looked at the list of conditions. And, you know, it starts off, you define a rule, you go to preferences, rules, and then you start defining a rule, and it'll say, you know, if any or all of the conditions are met. And the first pull down that you click on gives you a whole bunch of conditions here. And so I saw a couple that were keyed to date. Date sent and date received. I'm like, yeah, that's really not going to do it for him. You know, that's not very helpful.
Right.
But then something that I just had to do made me think of this. So if you look at the bottom of this list, it says edit header list. And header is the information at the beginning of the email that Mail App displays to you. So I clicked on that. And, you know, there's a few in there, from to, CC, subject. I added one called x-bin there, and we'll talk about why in a moment. But then here's where I had, you know, my, you know, flash of a genius, not genius. I won't say that. But then it occurred to me, well, even though there are some conditions that are keyed on date and they're kind of lame, why don't we add date again? So what I did is went to this, said edit header list, and added date. And I'm going to do that right now because I want to tell you what comes up after that.
Okay.
So I hit date.
Yep.
All right, so now when you click on the list of conditions here, oh, you're going to see that on top of the screen, date. Now, if you select that, you then get a list of five criteria. Contains, does not contain, begins with, ends with, and is equal to. And then I thought about what he's trying to do. I'm like, well, how could you possibly look at the date header and determine if it's, you know, like he was suggesting, and this inspired me, whether it's, you know, one part of the day or the other.
Right.
Now, this is the weird part, Dave, and that's why I think it's good we toss it around here. Now, at least my mail for my ISP has an AM or PM in the date field.
Right.
Well, now, what I suggested, though, then we can bounce it back and forth. What I suggested to him is, well, why don't you key on that? I know it's not going to give you a 50. I mean, we're not going to assume that half of the people send in the AM and PM, but I think it's close enough. So that was my suggestion. Then he got back to me and said, well, you know, that sounds like a good path to take, but my date header doesn't show AM or PM, but it does show the hour, minute, second. So I think what he's going to try to do, and now you can tell it's the hour because it's going to be, you know, two numbers and a colon.
Right.
So I think what he decided to do, and he's going to get back to us, but I think this is going to work, is, you know, have either one rule that has all of these, or, you know, create individual rules, but look for, you know, 00, 01, 02, 03, and so on. So I think he can put them all in one rule field. So basically, anything that's in one part of the day, put that in one mailbox. Anything that's in the other part of the day, based on the hour, put it in the other one.
Right. And actually, if you wanted to split it up as it came in throughout the day, you could do, you know, 00, 02, 04 in one, and then 1, 3, 5, 7, 9, 11, right, in the other. And that way, you know, you're going back and forth every hour. It's routing. Yeah. What criteria he used was space 00 colon or space 01 colon, because the minutes for the first 24 minutes of the hour, of course, that will also have a 0001 colon, right? Each one of those, but not the space in front of it. So that's what he did. Yeah, it was interesting. He wrote back and he said that while he, the date field from his ISP shows AM or PM, when he selects the date header in his mail rules, like you described, it auto fills the content with the header from the highlighted message. And in every case, it was auto converting it to 24-hour convention, which is very interesting. So, you know, but whatever works. I mean, as long as it's, you know, consistent with what works on your machine. And you do, sometimes you have to go into mail and go into the view menu, go to message, and say long headers, or even better, is view, message, and raw source, so that you can really see what mail's going to be able to see in there. I mean, for mine, if I go look at, and I'm curious about this, John, with you. You say that when you go and look at your message, it shows up AM or PM. Is that actually coming from your ISP if you look at view, message, raw source? Because I'd be surprised if your ISP was using AM or PM on their mail server and not just 24-hour time.
Oh, I'm gonna tell you in one moment here. So view.
Yep.
Raw source.
Yes.
All right, let's see. date. Nope. Okay. So mail's converting it. All right. Good point. So for example, I'm looking at one here, mun, comma, space 07, space mar, space 2011, space 19, colon 59, colon 55, and then space plus 0000, which is the
time zone offset.
Yeah, time zone. So, yeah. Okay. But, all right. So setting the rule to one of the elements in the time, and as you pointed out, yeah, space precedes the hour.
Yep.
Should do it. So just split it and then just assume I think it's going to be the best you're going to get. The other thing could be, and you know, this gets beyond, I think what he could do on his end would be to configure the mail server to kind of, you know, maybe have two different email addresses or something like that. That's another way. If you have control of, no, that's getting too complicated.
Well, it is and it isn't. But, you know, before we jump off this, I wanted to circle back to something you mentioned, and that is there's a header called X with a capital X dash been there with capital B and T. That header is created by Gmail when mail is being kind of rerouted through its system. And John, I know you mentioned it and I had it on my list too. It's a very valuable header to know about if you're doing any filtering on Gmail. If something comes into you and you are BCC'd on the message where your name is not listed in the to field, filtering on that X dash been there header can allow you to see that, yes, the message was sent to, you know, in your case, John at MacObserver.com or Dave at Mac, whatever, you know, or even feedback at MacGeekGab.com. In fact, that's how I have that filter built. So if
Dave, did you say feed? Oh, wait, it's not time for that yet. But you bring up a good point, because I had to do this because, oddly enough, Dave, a lot of mail that I get at Mac Observer, which is forwarded, has in the to field. And that's what I keyed on before. But for some bizarre reason, some people, I don't know if it's the email program they're using or whatever distribution system they use.
Yep.
It would be their address in the to field. And so my rule would miss it.
Right.
Until I found exactly what you said, is that I looked in the long headers and I found this field. So I guess multiple programs put it in there as kind of a cookie crumb that you can use. And now my filter takes anything that's sent to my Mac Observer address and puts it in my Mac Observer folder and makes me happy.
Prior to Gmail, X-been there was not what I used. I had one was called delivered-to, I think. But you can take a look through the raw headers and just look for your email address kind of further up the list anywhere other than from, and you'll see the name of the header. But it gets interesting. So, you know, he asked how would we skin this cat and then sort of headed us down a path that he was thinking, which was this whole filtering by date. I have a better idea, or a different idea anyway. And, you know, John, you said filtering on the mail server is far too complex. Well, it used to be, but, you know, I'll bring Gmail back into the picture. You have full control over the mail server with, at least in that respect, you don't have full control.
Well, I don't know
anything.
I don't know if he has access to his ISP's mail server.
But he could forward all these messages to Gmail and then actually have Gmail do some filtering and then forward them off differently depending on some criteria in them. So you could do it that way. The other way to do it would be to have them forward them to Gmail and leave them all there and simply use Gmail as kind of a poor man's support ticket repository, in that you leave the message in the inbox until you take it. So you can both log into Gmail, right? If you see a message, you say, I'll take this one. And as soon as you do it, it's marked as unread. So the person that's, you know, working alongside you, even if they're not right alongside you, can see, oh, that one's unread. That's fine. And then when you're done, you archive the message off into, you know, all mail or whatever, and it gets it out of the inbox and you're good to go. And that way, you know, if you've got a couple hours now, you can go through the stuff and clean out the queue. And then maybe later the other person working on it with you can go through, you know, the queue and clean it out and keep up with it that way too. So that would be how I would do it. And that way you're not futzing around with mail rules and making sure a certain Mac is on the line and all that to handle it. So that's my, that's my favorite.
Okay. That's good. I like the mail rules though. And it helped me learn something about mail rules. And that, if anything, you can add to the headers that the mail rules considers.
I
only recently found that out. So that's, I think, a very powerful tool to build your own. And you know, there may even be a mail plugin. We should, you know, there are a few sites that have some mail plugin. There may be a mail plugin that deals with this as well.
Yep. There certainly could be. Yep. You know, in the last regular show, in show 317, we talked about, or I talked about my my trip down or out to San Francisco and the various different 3G, and 4G mobile hotspots that I used. And we got a couple of questions, and Johnny's kind of brings us into the into the topic about that. He says, I just purchased a new 13-inch MacBook Air, which he loves. And he says, now that I have an iPad, an iPhone 4, along with the MacBook Air, would I still recommend the Verizon MiFi, or is there something else that would give him Wi-Fi access all the time? So let's talk about this, right? With the iPhone, there's a couple different options. And I'm going to rewind a little. You already have an iPhone, right? So both AT&T and, or Verizon now and AT&T, presumably as of Friday, because they've said that they're going to, both have hotspot availability in the iPhone itself. And they've matched pricing on it, sort of, right? It's $20 a month for 2 gigs of hotspot data. And then if you go over that, it's $20 for each additional gigabyte. That's the same for AT&T and Verizon. Now, each of those requires a data plan. And that's where the pricing gets a little bit different. Verizon, I believe you have to have their $29.99 unlimited data plan, which is the only one you can have for the iPhone, right, John?
Now, do you know? Because the thing is,
yeah,
I looked.
I do know.
Oh, no, sure. I know that. No, I know that. But my question is that when I've gone to the Verizon page,
yep,
there's ways that I can tweak my plan. And yeah, I see a little checkbox. Now, if
you can't do mobile hotspot without the data plan.
I understand okay. that. My question is, can I activate it and deactivate it on a month-to-month basis? And I haven't tried it because really I don't.
The hotspot, you mean?
Yes. Right now, if I go to my plan page, I can check a box and okay, so I can activate it for 1 month and then say, okay, I don't want it for the next month.
Correct. That's true of both AT&T and Verizon.
Oh,
that's right.
Okay.
Yes.
So if I need it,
if you need it, you can
3G.
Just kick it on. Right. So Verizon charges $30 for the unlimited data plan, which right now is the only data plan you can get, I think, with the iPhone.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, there's that and there's a corporate one, but I don't think many people go for the corporate one. And then, then there's Hotspot, which is an additional $20.
Right. And then AT&T requires you to be on their Data Pro plan. Now, AT&T has 3 data plans for iPhone users. They have an unlimited data plan that if you're on it, you can stay on it, but otherwise you can't get on it. And that's $30 a month. They have a 2 gig per month plan called their Data Pro plan, which is $25 per month. And then they have a 250 megabyte plan, which is $15 a month. You have to be on their Data Pro plan, which is $25 a month for 2 gigs of normal iPhone data. So that's your options with your iPhone itself, depending on how often you're going to be using either your MacBook Air or your iPad with Wi-Fi. One of those might work okay for you. Of course, if you're willing, you could jailbreak your iPhone and turn it into a hotspot with the MyWi app. The app is $10, I think. I heard a rumor it was going up to $20, and it works really well. But that uses your normal data plan, and of course, whether that's approved by your carrier or not is that's up to you and your carrier to decide. Outside of that, MiFis are offered by Verizon, AT&T, Virgin, which is Sprint Mobile. Or Sprint prepaid, I'm sorry. And the latter is definitely the cheapest. It's let's see, $10 for 10 days and 100 megs of data, $50 for unlimited data for a month. And they say that if you go over 2.5 gigs in any 1 month, they may begin limiting your throughput, but you'll still have access to the data, which is kind of a nice little middle ground. So that's Virgin Mobile, which is also Sprint prepaid. AT&T's MiFi pricing is $35 for 3 gigs, $10 for each gig over that. Verizon's MiFi pricing is the same, $35 for 3 gigs, $50 for 5 gigs, $80 for 10 gigs, and it's still the same $10 over that. And MiFi's run about $150. And of course, lastly, you could go and buy that LG Optimus 5 phone on Virgin Mobile and pay $150 for the phone and then $25 a month for unlimited data, which is your cheapest way of getting unlimited mobile hotspot data. So there's lots of options. I would go with the Optimus 5 or Optimus 5. I'm seeing Optimus V and reading it as a Roman numeral. It's not. It's V for Virgin. but, I would do that as the first step, as long as where you're going to be is covered by Virgin/Sprint's 3G network, and they probably have the worst or least coverage of every vendor. It works well when you're in coverage. They just aren't, you know, widespread through lots of different areas. So, but that would be the first thing to check. Yeah. That's my feeling on it. Hopefully that answers everybody's questions. We got lots of email kind of along those same lines. So. Do you have any questions, Sean?
About this?
Yeah. About this.
No, I found a, okay, good. Well, you know, I found a little app here. I don't know if you've used this. It's called Data Man.
Okay.
It's a little iPhone app. It shows both your cellular and your Wi-Fi data usage. There's a,
that's cool,
a free version, which I have my iFi right now, iPhone.
Yep.
Right now. And then I think also the and I assume all the carriers do this, but at least Verizon now, the Verizon app that you can put on the iPhone,
yep,
shows what I can see is a pretty accurate summary of how much 3G data I've used, sure, during the billing period. So I don't need this app. Well, I like this app because it shows both my Wi-Fi and my cellular data consumption. Because you know, at one point I was like, you know, should I have Wi-Fi on along with 3G? And as far as I can tell, the answer is pretty much yes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There's no reason not to. So if Wi-Fi is not available, it's not available. But for a while there, I turned off 3G. And yeah, that's something you don't want to do, because then that prevents the phone from getting things like alerts that you got a voicemail.
Right.
As I found.
So that's a pretty cool app. So Data Man, there's a free version. There's also the paid version is only $2. And it will not only monitor, I'm assuming you have to put in your username and password for Verizon or AT&T. Is that right, to make it work, or no? Does it get it out of the phone?
No, I think it just somehow secretly, I don't recall having to give it that. You give it your, okay, billing date, and you give it a date allowance, and then, yeah, it'll start yelling at you if you approach your, which I don't think your provider will do, because they want to nail you with the overage fee, right?
Right, right. So does the free, well, you can get text messages. AT&T will send you messages, free text messages, if you're approaching limits, for sure.
Yeah, here, I don't recall having to enter, okay, anything. I think it's just somehow monitored. There must be an API in the phone.
Yeah.
Where,
yeah,
it just knows how much data is used for things. So yeah, you give it your billing date and your data allowance, and then it'll warn you at certain thresholds.
Are you able, do those warnings come in as like push notifications or is that only in the paid version?
I haven't gotten any yet.
Okay. Oh, right. Right. Right.
Well, I'm glad we talked about this. So
that's,
yeah,
good.
So it's a good app that'll do more than, because I assume, again, your provider is not going to warn you when you approach your cap. It'd be nice if they did, but I don't think, right, they generally do.
Right.
I don't think it works to their advantage to do that.
I think they have to, though. I think they have to offer
the
facility. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah. And it looks like they've got another one called Voice Man that does something similar. So, but I haven't heard anything about that. So. All right. Let's go to Tim, shall we, John?
Oh, this was a can of worms. Yeah, okay.
Hello, this is Tim from Danbury, Connecticut. I have a quick question regarding shortcuts in the browser windows, you know, the column view in the Finder, where you can place things in the sidebar to get to them. I'd like to place folders there of current projects I'm working on, and I've started storing my current projects on secure disk images. When I eject the secure disk image, all my shortcuts disappear. And I've noticed the same behavior for any external USB hard drives. If I place a shortcut to a folder on an external drive, then eject the drive, all the shortcuts disappear. And when I remount the drive, the shortcuts do not reappear. Is there any way to make a hard link to one of these instead of a link to the file ID so they don't disappear? I don't mind if they don't work when the volume is not accessible, but it's really annoying to have to reset all my bookmarks when I start a session of programming. Thank you for your help. This is where you cut me off.
Awesome. So yeah, we both kind of went through this and came up with, you know, a couple of things. The simple answer is, yeah, you're right. All that stuff disappears. And when you eject a USB, any local volume, a USB or a disk image or anything, strangely enough, they do not disappear when you make them from network volumes, which is how I've got everything set up here. So when I heard this, I thought, well, that's sort of odd. But they definitely disappear with local volumes, and they don't reappear, obviously, as Tim said. The short answer is I think the best thing to do would be to create a folder on your local hard drive, on your boot drive, maybe somewhere in documents or on your desktop if you care. But and then inside that folder, put aliases to all the folders and projects that you want to work on. Then take that main folder and drag it into your sidebar. That will persist. It's one level deeper, right? One level detached, but at least that folder sticks around, and then you can click there and you've got shortcut access to all those directories that way. And I think, I mean, that's it. It was a very exhaustive process for us to kind of rule out everything else. We couldn't find any other way of forcing that list to populate. But if one of you knows, let us know. Is there anything to add here, John?
It's a mess.
Well, it's not really
I was
a mess.
Just very, no, I, well, no, I was very disappointed in the lack of what I thought should work, not working.
Yep.
You know, like being able to put a shortcut in certain places in the Finder, and it just wouldn't let you.
Right.
So you held my hand and walked me through how the very specific way you can do this in order to get it to work reliably.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting one for sure. Anything to add, or are we good to move on to Santa, I think.
I'm sorry. I just got a chuckle.
Okay. So Santa says he was listening to last Monday's Mac Geek Gab, and he says, here's a problem similar to the hot corners problem you two were talking about. In Aperture, when working in full screen mode, moving the pointer to the bottom of the image pops up a film strip of the image files. This would probably be considered a feature, except when the mouse pointer is a retouch brush and you need to work on the bottom of an image. Up pops that film strip covering what you need to see, and the only way to get back is to move the mouse, which is now an active brush, out of the way to whatever correction is active. Yikes, that's hard to explain. Do you have a way to turn off the pop-up? John, you're our Aperture dude.
I am becoming an Aperture dude day by day.
That's great.
And so I came across, with a little Google foo, I came across a solution to this. So number one, I don't typically work in full screen mode, though it's a very nice feature that lets you, you know, get maximum image size. And typically they put a toolbar across the top of the screen that, you know, is the various tools that you can invoke. But yeah, I verified this. So as your cursor creeps towards the bottom of the screen, they put what's called a film strip that shows the photos that are in the project or the album or whatever you're working on. And I'm like, well, that's kind of neat. And yeah, Santa pointed out, well, it's kind of a pain in the neck if you happen to want to edit that part of the photo, and right, it's where the film strip is. And so the quick answer is no. As far as I can tell, there is no way to get rid of it. That's the bad news. Here's the good news. Well, it's good news. And this was, to me, was not intuitive at all. So I tried clicking on it, right clicking every, and nothing worked. Then I found out, again, doing a little research, you can grab it and put it somewhere else.
Oh,
so you can drag it to the left side of the screen, the right side of the screen, or I guess even the top of the screen.
Right.
So while you can't get rid of it, you can get it the heck out of the way so you can do your work on the part of the image when you're using a touch up or another tool that's specific to that portion of the screen when you're running in full screen mode. So, but again, I dug through the preferences and could not find a way to disable that functionality. So I think it's kind of a screw up in that they do that and you can't disable it, but you can move it. And you can also, there's a little slider. You can actually lock that toolbar, which may be another thing depending on.
I was just going to ask, could you just force it to stay open and then the picture wouldn't be there? So.
Yeah. It from what I saw, yeah, you can. There's a little slider, and if you slide it, it's kind of like a pin in a lot of other programs.
Okay.
It'll lock it to that part of the screen, and then I think it'll scale the image.
Right.
Which may not be appropriate because, you know, you get relatively less resolution.
Right.
And that it's not quite full screen, but that's another way to do it. So that's the answer.
That's your story. All right.
I dragged it, moved it, and it moved where I wanted to put it. So that's going to, it's a little extra work, but it'll solve his problem.
All right. While we're on the topic of Aperture, Leslie wrote in. He says, hi, John and Dave. I sync photos to my iPhone from iPhoto. if I were to buy Aperture, would I be able to sync photos from that program as well? And then, yeah, so go ahead, John, go.
Well, I want to be clear. I want to make a distinction here first, because this has come up, and especially using the different programs here.
Yeah.
Well, I want to be clear that sync occurs within iTunes.
That's right. We talked about this last time. In fact, with photos, sync is even the wrong term, even though that's what iTunes uses, right? It's, there is import, which happens into iPhoto, and sync, which happens out to the phone from iTunes, right? So it's import right. is from phone to computer, and then sync, which is, again, a misnomer, is from computer to phone via iTunes. At least that's where the terminology is. So, yeah, so that's right. So I think he's talking about importing photos from Aperture. That would be right. Although he probably also wants to sync photos from Aperture out.
I'm going to cover all of it.
Okay, good. Go.
So the thing is, you can do either. So the good news is that iPhoto and Aperture both see the iPhone as an import photo source.
Great.
So in that case, the answer is yes. Now you may have to go in Aperture. There's preferences, and that there's a place where you can, I don't have the specifics in front of me, but there's a place where you can define what happens during import operations. And one is, or I think it just shows up. If you plug in the iPhone, it should just show up in Aperture as a source of photos when you've taken with the camera application. So in that case, the answer is yes. But I also want to go into, because I think it may be, maybe a hidden question, or maybe not.
Yep.
But iTunes, and this is very interesting, so iTunes gives you a number of options for syncing photos with your iPhone, or right. I think any iDevice. And they're as follows. So you can sync with a folder on your Mac. And when you select a folder, it can, as an option, let you choose subfolders. So you don't have to sync your entire...
Sure.
You should probably have all your pictures in your pictures folder. So you can sync subfolders, give you some granularity. Here's the neat part, though. You can also synchronize folders with either iPhoto or Aperture. Now, if you sync with iPhoto, you can choose, and there's subtle differences here because the programs have different capabilities, as we've discussed. You can sync with albums, with events, and here's the cool part that I never realized, faces.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Because, of course, both iPhoto and Aperture have the ability, if you train it, to recognize certain faces. Now, with Aperture, it's slightly different. If you're syncing with iTunes, you can choose projects or albums, which are two different ways of organizing your work within Aperture, or faces as well.
Oh, cool.
And of course, the other application that always talks to any photo device, whether it be a camera or at least a camera that's tethered via cable, is image capture. Is another way you can pull photos off of your iDevice. So I think that covers... Or USB camera, or even a scanner.
Sure.
Image capture is a little different. It sees, now I think about it, I think maybe iPhoto or Aperture may be able to see scanners. Or maybe not. I think they can.
They might be able to. I don't know about iPhoto. It wouldn't surprise me if Aperture did. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think we've covered all the different options of either importing or syncing photos with the iPhone.
Good. All right. Let's see. Moving on to Joe. Joe has an interesting question. He writes, I have a time capsule with two external USB drives plugged in via a USB hub. They contain movies which I play through iTunes to Apple TV. I usually always eject volumes before I switch them off. But how do I do this with the time capsule? It does not have an off switch. Am I supposed to leave it on all the time? That's what I'm doing now because I fear switching it off and on daily may eventually cause problems with it and or the USB drives. This is an interesting thing, John.
What do you think?
Well, the time capsule is not built. It does not have an on-off switch for the same reason that my Linksys wireless router doesn't have an on-off switch, and pretty much any other, and a cable modem doesn't have an on-off switch, although some have those standby switches, which I've always sort of...
Well, it could be because they're being cheap.
I don't think so. See, I think these are, they are being cheap, of course. They're going to make it as inexpensively as possible.
That's probably 5 cents, 5 or 10 cents for a power switch button or switch.
Yeah, and then the wiring and all that stuff. Sure. But, but really it's because I believe this device's primary functionality is twofold. It's that of a router, right? It can be your gateway to the internet. And it can also be your time machine destination, network accessible storage, right? And for those two purposes, you would presumably want the device on all the time. Now, that's likely why it doesn't have an on-off switch. It also is likely why it wasn't really designed with the idea of someone turning it on and off, and probably not tested for that. So yes, you could turn it off. You could just treat it like a USB drive and a hub with other USB drives. But I worry, because when you turn the time or when you power the time capsule up, it takes a couple of minutes. You hear the hard drive in there spin up, and clearly something happens. I don't know. I would leave it on. You could turn off the wireless circuit in it if you don't want to use it wirelessly, and that would save some power. And then, of course, it can spin down its hard drives as well as the hard drives of the that are connected to it USB. And otherwise, I'd leave the time capsule itself on. I'd worry about turning it on and off every day, simply because it's not built to have that done.
My thoughts on this, Dave?
Yeah, go.
Well, it was in my response to this. So number one, it sounds like Joe may not be even be using this as a router.
I don't think he is.
Yeah. It sounds like he's just using it as, I would think, a time capsule, but also a way to allow wireless access to USB drives plugged into it.
Or network access to USB
drives. Network access.
Right. Could be wireless.
Now, it brings up the question, and I think this is a long-running battle in many quarters. As you said, I'm going to say I'm with you. I'm not going to violently disagree with you, but I don't know if... I mean, obviously, because it doesn't have a power switch, it was not designed to be powered on and off. Though, of course... So my suggestion, and let me know your thoughts on this, is that I don't... My gut kind of tells me that turning it on and off and on and off and on and off could stress things out. On the other hand, I mean, lots of other devices handle that constantly. So unless they put, a really substandard power supply in here or hard drive,
I wouldn't.
I'm questioning whether power cycling any device can shorten its life.
Well, yeah, I think that's your fundamentally religious battle, right? But
yes.
But yeah, I wouldn't so much worry about the drive in there, right? I mean, that's going to be powered up and down all the time. But yeah, the power supply, it could be fine with it, but it's not built or tested for it necessarily. And neither are any of the other components in there, right? I don't know, I don't know that it's good to turn the wireless functionality, the wireless circuit on and off all the time. I don't know. Maybe it is.
I think I'm with you on that. I mean, the only suggestion I had is he may want to consider a power strip for both the drives and the device itself to just synchronize or make it a little easier to power all of them on and off. But my time capsule, because it's my router, I actually have a printer plugged into it. And that's the other thing, because I have a wire, my inkjet plugged into it. I pretty much want that available whenever I want. So, I've been running mine. I mean, you and I both, I think, have the same model. I mean, mine's been on for, 2 years, I think.
Yeah, right.
Most part, unless I have to, something bad happens. But it's been on constantly, and I think it's designed to be used that way. So that's how I would suggest to use it.
Yeah. All right. Moving on to Lisa. She says, "Hi, guys. I have some old Apple Works files that worked at first when I installed Snow Leopard, but now a message comes up asking me if I want to install Rosetta. Wikipedia says that Rosetta is fine for Snow Leopard, but toast once Lion comes out. Do you have an opinion as to whether it is worth it to install this software or just to bag all the apps that require it?" Okay, so... John, I'll let you take the answer, but just to clarify what she's talking about here, Rosetta is the translator built into Leopard and Snow Leopard that allows you to run PowerPC code on your Intel Mac. And I think it was, it may have even been there in Tiger, right? In 10.4. But certainly pre Snow Leopard, it was enabled by default when you installed the OS, and now it's not. But as rumors have it, yeah, once Lion comes out, I don't think Lion will be included in Rosetta, at least not according to Wikipedia here. And so once Lion comes out, Rosetta will simply be remembered as when someone misremembers that old song from Toto, right? Mm-hmm. Is that right, John? Oh, never mind. Go ahead. So you've got some opinions.
I'm not the musician here.
I know.
I'm going to answer some questions that have not yet been asked, but I'm going to answer them anyway. So how do you know what applications on your machine would potentially take advantage of Rosetta? And I'm going to tell you probably the quickest way. Well, there's a couple of ways. So one is you can run System Profiler, and then you're going to see a software category, and then you're going to see applications. This is where I would look. And if you look in applications, you're going to see a column called kind. And what are you going to see here? You're going to see a number of different things. And I'm looking at mine right now on my mini. I see Intel, which is optimal. I see universal. And what universal means is that the application has both Intel and PowerPC code in it. And of course, the OS is smart enough to run the Intel code. I see some things that are PowerPC. And those are the applications that are going to be taking advantage of Rosetta. You want to make every effort, and I have. Now, these are a cruft, actually, I think, left over from apps I don't even use anymore. But the thing is, I made an effort when I went from the G5 to the Mini, that before I did that, I looked at all the applications on the G5, which, of course, was PowerPC, and made sure that I replaced them with universal applications so I wouldn't have to use Rosetta. Now, you know, you're saying, well, Rosetta's there. It does what it does. What's the downside? Well, the downside is that there is a performance hit you take running Rosetta. It's very clever. I mean, it's transparent. You typically, unless, you know, as was pointed out, the you know, OS comes up and says, huh, what's this? Do you want me to install Rosetta? You don't even really know it's running. And then the fourth category, of course, you'll see what you shouldn't see. And if you see it, it's not going to run, of course, is classic, which is like, you know, old school OS 9 stuff. So my opinion here is, she got back to us, basically said, I think there were AppleWorks files. And I guess the AppleWorks app is, you know, dead.
PowerPC dead, only. Right.
Is gone and will not be updated. So a suggestion in general is to maybe comb through your apps and just make sure. Well, I think the decision, I think she said, you know what? Forget it. I'm not even going to install it because I don't want to, you know, have to. I want to be ready for Lion, and I don't want to take the risk. And I guess the AppleWorks files can be run. Again, the feedback we got, they can be imported into other applications that don't need to use Rosetta. So Rosetta was, kind of a crutch to help people make the transition, but especially in light of the fact that, as far as we know, Lion will not support it. Everybody should be purging those PowerPC apps from their list of applications if you want the new hotness of Lion.
Yeah, I don't know if Zamzar, remember that? Zamzar is an online file conversion utility. And it's really handy if you don't have the software on your machine to convert files from, like, you know, old WordPerfect or whatever to Word. You can upload a file. You go to Zamzar.com, you upload the file, you put in what you want to convert it to, and you put your email address in. Of course, you know, if it's something uber confidential, chances are a human will never see this, but you are sending it in the clear up to, some other website. But Zamzar might convert AppleWorks files. I don't know. I'm trying to dig here while you were talking, and
well, I think Lee was saying that Pages or other apps, especially Apple apps, for the most part, could parse these these files or import them, and so you don't have to create them from scratch. So
So
I think she's in good shape, and I think she decided, I'm not even going to install Rosetta. the answer was the reason the message came up is, and I recall this. Rosetta is by default not installed with Snow Leopard. I guess that was the question.
Correct.
On a new machine.
But it will offer to install it for you, like she's talking about. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I think when I installed Snow Leopard on my MacBook, so if you go to the, there's usually in most installers a customize option. So there's a default install and a custom install. So on Snow Leopard, if you went to it was a customize button, there would be a checkbox where you could check and say, by the way, can you install Rosetta while you're installing everything else? And they would do it at that point in time rather than prompting you, which I think the prompting is a good thing because it, it's kind of a warning saying, yeah, I got to do something extra. Do you really want to do this?
Right, right.
Again, I don't think there's a downside to running Rosetta other than a performance hit, but yeah, you want to prepare for the future.
Yep. All right. I want to talk about our next sponsor, John, which is Smile Software, or Smile as they are called, at smilesoftware.com with PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro. The general concept behind PDF Pen is it is an app that allows you to open and manipulate, with a focus on the latter, PDF files. You can paste in graphics. I've talked about this before, where I grab a signature that I have written, right? Because we don't have Lion yet and all those cool new features people are talking about. But I take a signature that I scanned in, and then I'm able to paste that right on top of a PDF contract, place it exactly where I want, go and grab the text tool, put the date in next to it, and then I can save that back out as a PDF and send it back to the person who needed my document with, or my signature on a document. You can also edit PDF Pen, edit text in a PDF with PDF Pen. It's actually really cool. As long as it's PDF text, you can highlight it, and then the little edit text button comes up. So if you, if somebody sends you a PDF to edit, and says, oh, if you find any spelling errors, let me know. You can actually do that there. You can change anything you want, which could include maybe even, maybe you don't like your gate at the boarding area. So you change it before you print your boarding pass. I don't know if that'd be between you and the FBI. but you certainly could do that because it allows you to edit all sorts of stuff. If you scan a document, it includes OCR, optical character recognition software, right inside PDF Pen, and you can convert that to text. And then, of course, with that feature I just talked about, you can edit the text. Very, very cool. That's PDF Pen. PDF Pen Pro adds a couple other features, including the ability to convert websites to PDFs, create PDF forms like you've seen. You can do those in PDF Pen Pro. They work on Windows or the Mac. And you can even create and edit a table of contents in PDF Pen Pro. So both are available at smilesoftware.com for download. PDF Pen is $59.95 when you are ready to purchase, and PDF Pen Pro is $99.95. But again, you can go get a free trial of both of them. Check them out. See which one is the right one for you, and then download it. All available at smilesoftware.com. And with that, John, I think it's time to head over to the Mac Geek Gab forums, where there were a couple of good questions recently. Mac Geek Gab forums are, of course, are at MacObserver.com in the forums section. And man, it's gotten to be a great community out there. You folks are awesome. Not only are there people coming through and asking questions, but it's not just me answering questions anymore. We've got a whole slew of you out there helping out and answering questions. John, we would love to see you there. There's some great stuff happening, and
I'm going to put it on my calendar and stop by.
All right, good. And so we have two questions that came up in the forums that I thought would be good to share with all the listeners here in the show. So, the first comes from listener and forum member SKP. SKP writes, originally, I thought my MacBook Pro was having disk drive issues. However, if I insert disk one of Mac OS X while logged in, it reads the disk just fine. And then I can start the rebuild of Mac OS X from there up until it tells me to restart. After rebooting, the disk spins for a minute and then it just hangs at the white screen. The same thing happens when I attempt to reboot with the disk in the drive holding the C key down. Also happens when I try to use an external disk drive. So I'm ruling out the drive at this point. Anyone have any suggestions as to what else I can try? I just want to start over and rebuild my MacBook Pro. Okay. There's a couple things that can keep the system from being able to boot to the optical drive. One of them is the SMC and even the PRAM. So Command Option PR on reboot to reset the PRAM. Resetting the SMC is a little more involved. We'll put an article in the show notes. Depends on your exact Mac model. But my gut says it's not that complicated. I think you just have a bad disk. And the disk might be readable when you just mount it, but the boot sectors or whatever might have gotten scratched. And I think that's what's going on. John, you got any thoughts?
Yes, I do.
Good.
Oh, about this?
Yes.
Well, maybe a long shot, but you know, I have run into recently and have helped out some folks on Twitter
yep.
with problems with their CD drive. And in one case, it was actually someone who had a problem, which I also had, with a dual layer disc not burning.
Okay.
That's a slightly different problem, but the solution, Dave. So, you know, at first, yes, the process here eliminated, I think, though I'm not positive here, but I'm going to suggest something to do anyways. Get a lens cleaner. I'm thinking if the drives are in the same environment and maybe it's dusty or dirty or dander or pets or whatever, you know, creatures you have in your environment, you may have the drives may have collected. And it was funny because one of the folks that follows me actually had a problem with a dual layer disc, and I suggested it to him, and I was shocked that it worked because it worked. Well, it worked for me, but I tossed out the advice, not thinking that I thought I just had a unique situation here.
Yeah.
But he said, "Oh my gosh, John, I went to the, you know, local store and I bought a lens cleaner, and now I can burn my dual layer discs." So another thought could be, you know, substandard media is always an issue here.
Yeah, but it's not, I mean, we're not, he's not talking about burning, you know, but so you're the lens cleaner
or degradation,
just
depending on the discs, right?
Any lens cleaner, John?
I mean, I have one from years ago, but I think they all operate in a similar fashion. And that I think the assumption is that the lens parks itself at the, you know, innermost, you know, close to the, to the inside. And I think that's where most of these cleaners have the brushes. So,
and it was okay to use a lens cleaner. Well, that was my next question, is it's okay to use a lens cleaner on a slot loading drive?
Well, as long as the lens cleaning disc is a full sized.
Well, yeah, but you know, they sometimes have that little brush that kind of pokes down, and that's okay in your slot loader. That worked for you.
It worked for me, and it worked for the other person who I think was on a mini, which also has a slot load. So my experience has been the lens cleaner is always something to try if you're having problems. You know, in my case, it was writing, but you know, it could also be reading.
Yep.
I think it's a long shot, though.
I do too.
I think it's something else, but
You know, with a damaged disc, the other option would be that, and I do this a lot. I've talked about this with DVDs because, you know, for a long time from Netflix, we were getting DVDs that were scratched to the point where our DVD player would not play them. But I could rip them, you know, using Handbrake or whatever on my Mac, and then just play the file back to the TV or reburn it or what have you. And the same concept could apply here. Is go and use Disk Utility to make an image of that DVD and then reburn that DVD that back out to, you know, a writable DVD. That might be enough. You know, it might be the kind of thing where it's damaged enough that the, you know, during the boot process, the timing or whatever, it, you know, it's slowing down too much and it can't read the disk. But if all you're doing is creating an image, you might get past that. You know, you might just be able to make that work. So that would be my recommendation. And if not, you know, find a buddy who has the exact same disc and copy it. You know, you're licensed. I think your attorney could fight that for you if you had to.
Yeah. The only other thing I'll mention is cleaning discs. So of course that's another thing because I mean, sometimes even Redbox, Dave, I'll get discs where, well, what do people do? What do they hand them to their kids to, you know, as pacifiers or what? I mean, I've seen some stuff on, I don't want to know what it is, but usually people are pretty good. But the one tip is that based on the way that they do error correction. So one thing is that any optical media typically uses something called Reed-Solomon error correction. And then what they do is they put additional data on the disc. So if a little part of it gets damaged, there's enough extra data, you could say it's wasteful, to recompose it and you won't get a skip or anything like that. The only problem is that works if you clean the disc and you clean it from the inside out. The thing is that data is arranged in a circular pattern. So here's a tip: if you're going to clean a disc, do not clean it in a circular motion, because the problem is if you inadvertently create a circular scratch, you're going to make matters a lot worse.
Is why they tell us to clean discs that I didn't? Because I figured the chances of me making a circular scratch are the same as me making a, you know, a scratch across the disc. Why would it matter? I don't want to do it at all.
That is exactly why. So if you clean it from the center out, if you do create a scratch, it'll be a scratch across the error correction data.
So if I'm I won't create a scratch, it doesn't matter which way I clean my disk. And well, I realize that there's a caveat there that, you know, no, you can't ever be that certain. But right.
So that's the other thing. And actually, you may want to take the disks in question. I mean, my local video store has what appears to be a professional disk cleaning machine.
Really?
I mean, that's the other thing. Well, actually, I see them running it. I mean, it's kind of fun. I mean, whenever I go, it's a small local shop that I love going to, and they're constantly running this thing. And it's I mean, I guess it puts some sort of I don't know exactly what it is. I'll have to look at what the brand is. But every time they get a disk back, in order to avoid people coming back and screaming at them saying they're selling defective disks, because they also sell them after the fact, they will, I think by practice, they will always clean the disks before they put them back in circulation. Because again, I don't know what people are doing with these things other than putting them in their player and watching them. Or putting them in the case, which is the only thing you should be doing with that disk. I don't know.
Yeah. Interesting. All right. One more from the forums. Let me see if I can coalesce this all together. One of our listeners, one of our visitors to the forums, was having a problem where the sound on his Mac Pro would not stay assigned to the right device. He would change it from the internal speakers to something else. And when he would reboot, boom, it would come back. And that was that. He wanted to keep it persistent. And apparently there is a problem with Mac Pros running Snow Leopard. And there's an article here Intruder, actually, in our forums, said go to the hard drive, open the library folder, open the preferences folder, and open the audio folder. And there are two files to delete: com.apple.audio.devicesettings.plist and com.apple.audio.systemsettings.plist. Then reopen system preferences, go to sound and set them the way you want, close the sound preferences and restart. And typically that works. So for those of you with Mac Pros that are having issues with Snow Leopard getting it to keep the sound where it should be, that's hopefully the answer for you. Any thoughts on that, John?
I hope so.
All right, good.
And the other thing could be, you and I both experienced this little tangent, but I remember a point where I had a little problem with my sound output.
Oh.
On my MacBook Pro. I think you did too at one point.
I did.
Well, what happened is all of a sudden I got no sound and I was like, what the heck is wrong? And then I happened to notice, I think it was in a hotel. We were at an event.
Yep.
And I looked on the side of the machine and I saw a red light. I'm like, that's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Apparently on the port or any machine, I think almost every Mac has a dual, analog digital sound output port.
That's right.
And I guess it got stuck and the solution was very low tech. It was jam a toothpick in there and ungum whatever got gummed. And then all of a sudden it said, you're not up. But it got stuck in the optical mode.
Yeah,
I was scratching my head for the longest time saying, why did my computer all of a sudden not make any noise? And then when I looked in the sound control system preference, it said optical. And I'm like, that's not right.
Digital out. So here's what happens, folks, is your headphone jack. The outer part of it is built for an analog signal that you plug in and, it sends sound to it. All the way in, though, there is a little light and it's red, like John said. When you put the appropriate adapter in there, it triggers that little switch to turn that light on. And of course, John, you had a MacBook Pro where that was kicked. I've actually got one. In fact, the MacBook Pro that Lisa is using now is permanently in that mode. And I had tried all kinds of different things and had not been able to get it fixed. In fact, I was just working on it yesterday. One of our listeners to the premium show had sent in an email where he had found or one of his friends had found an article saying put a tiny bit of WD-40 in there. And then slide either a toothpick or even just regular headphones in and out to kind of work that in and free that up. And I put probably more WD-40 than I should have in there yesterday. But I kept putting more in. I put it on the end of a toothpick or a pin, and just kind of drip it into the slot. was the safest okay. way I could figure
now,
to get it.
Now
in there.
I remember what worked for me. So I read okay. articles that suggested a toothpick.
Yep.
But here was another suggestion. And fortunately, in most hotels, they give you not only stationery, but pens.
Yes.
I pulled, I think it was a Bic pen, and okay. I basically pulled the pen out of the tube that it was in, and the innards of the
really?
Pen was just the right size. Well, it was long enough.
Yeah,
the thing is, it was long
right,
enough to
right.
stuff into the hole. Ah. And so I just stuffed it in there, you know, of course, you know, not point end, but the other end. And that was the size where it was small enough. The diameter was small enough where I could poke it in there. And then, yeah, somehow it nudged the switch that then put it back into analog mode, and life was
yeah,
good.
I have but, been able to, yesterday I wasn't able to, but in the past with hers, I was able to with a, I did it with a paperclip, which I'm sure is, you know, ooh, not advised, but it's fine.
A metal paper. Nice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm. But, well, I figure you're putting all kinds of metal in there with speakers and yeah, headphones all right. and all that. Right. But, yeah. But I was able to get in there and jiggle it around, and I found where the switch is, and I was able to get it to stay in analog mode, but only while I held it in there. But I couldn't even get it to do that yesterday, which was somewhat frustrating. Mm. But anyway, it's, you know, it's just those fun things that that keep us doing what we do here because we love it so much. But unfortunately, the time has come, the walrus said.
For
talk
what?
Of many things. Cabbages and sealing wax. Cabbages and kings. Anyway, let's see. Next week, fainting in coils. No, next week... What? I'm going to be at South by Southwest, but I'm thinking we can do a show while I'm there, assuming one of my many internet connection options works. So it would either be the hotel.
You have more than anyone I know, so
I know.
I certainly hope so.
You would think we'd be able to make this work.
I mean, but, I'm looking right now, Skype. I mean, look, I'm looking at iStat menus, which is yeah. one of my favorites, and I'm doing about 7K up and down, so you shouldn't need a heck of a lot of bandwidth, Dave.
No, my concern is we have about, right now we've got about a 30 millisecond round trip time,
oh.
and over those wireless solutions, it's usually about 200 yeah. or, you know, somewhere between 150 and 250, so we'll have to see, but I'm thinking we should do a show next week, and I'm thinking it should be cool stuff found, because, well, regardless of whether we do it next week or not, the next show that we do is cool stuff found, because we have the list, John, is ridiculous. It's
not just you and I.
Way
I mean,
too long.
You and I have found a couple of cool things, but
oh, yeah, not just it's not us. It's
but
them.
A tip of the hat,
yeah.
Them, the listeners.
Yes,
thank you, listeners. You guys are all cool. Well, except for that one person, which well.
No,
you're all cool. I'm just goofing around.
I'm counting
Dave,
quickly here, John. I think I have 35 things on the Cool Stuff
wow.
Found list. Yeah. Yeah.
Great. And if you want to contribute to the Cool Stuff Found list before the next show,
or
you
ask
know one
questions.
Thing, Dave, or ask questions, or just say hi, or, you know, whatever you'd like to do, I would suggest that you get in touch with us. And one way you can get in touch with us, Dave, is to send us an email. If you want to send us an email, I would send it to feedback@macgeekgab.com.
Oh, no, John. As I said before, it's feedback@macgeekgab.com.
Well, other than you kind of getting that wrong, I agree with you. feedback@macgeekgab.com. But that's not the only way, Dave. You could call us on the telephone. And if you want to call us on the phone, what would you do?
I'd call on the phone. I'd call 206-666-GEEK, which is...
Oh, I know this. 4, after all, 4-3-3-5. And, of course, Skype, which we're using right now. You could Skype us at...
MacGeekGab. But that's
amazing.
Not what we use while we're recording the show, because, you know, we've got to make sure we, you know, we can't be interrupted while we're doing the show here.
Huh?
You can call us and leave us a message on Skype while we're doing the show.
Oh, of course. Yes.
Right. That's what I meant.
And what else? Yeah, there's this Twitter thing. The official feed for the show where you can get all sorts of updates about what's happening with the show is Matt Geekab. You can
Matt
follow
Geekab.
Me at John F. Braun.
It's one of my favorite podcasts.
And it's probably also your favorite Twitter feed.
Yes, it is.
Which I like because the client I use now can support multiple accounts, which is very cool.
I'd
and
say
I still
the name
can't
of your client,
it.
But every time I say it, I curse and I'm worried about...
Well, it's Yoru... Yeah.
Yeah, that one. We'll put
for
a link in the show notes, folks.
Yes. No, it's an excellent client. Now dual account or multiple account support.
I'm still using Twitter for the Mac that I got through the Mac App Store.
Are you kidding me?
No, it's great.
Didn't they introduce the, I'm not going to say what it's called, but didn't they introduce a undesirable feature as of late?
Is that in the Mac version? I think that's only in the iOS version.
Yeah, the iOS version. They added a trend bar, which you can't get rid of, which has many people shaking their fists.
That has not bothered me on the iPad. Maybe it's only on the iPhone version. And I use Twitter on my iPhone for that. And I use Twitter's app on the iPad. But I haven't noticed any problems on the iPad. Actually, you know what I do? This is actually a little interesting workflow. I like to be alerted when there are replies to me and direct messages on Twitter. Mm-hmm. But I don't like Twitter's iPhone app. And I didn't even like it before the current rev. But what they do offer, because they're Twitter, is they offer push notifications when there are when there's, you know, events that happen. You can have it, you can configure it per account. You can, you know, get pretty granular with it. So what I do is I launch every time after I reboot my iPhone, I launch Twitter's Twitter account on here, and then I quit. But that starts up the whole notification process. And then I use Twitterlater to manage everything, but I get little, push alerts on my phone when events happen that I want to know about. So it's good. I like it. It's fantastic. Awesome.
Desktop.
It's great, John. I tell you, it's great. Hi.
Calm down, man.
Okay.
So on desktop, I use Yoru Fukuro. Y-O-R-U-F-U-K-U-R-O-U. I'll link to it, of course.
John, but they'll go to your link.
But I like Usfura is what I use on the iPhone.
Okay.
And that's a nice one. Well, it does a lot of things I like, so it separates all the messages. But it also has, like the client I just mentioned, this just I love. I feel like a secret agent. It has a translate feature.
Oh, that's cool.
So for people that post things, especially I follow a few people that post things in Arabic. I mean, I can't read Arabic, but even in Spanish, which I'm kind of good at,
sure,
it'll translate using the Google Translate API, which to me is just so cool.
Check that out. That's cool. Huh. All right.
Well, in addition, Twitter. Okay, we got Mac Geek Gab.
Right.
I am John F. Braun. Dave Hamilton is Dave Hamilton. Pilot Pete, who is being a pilot somewhere, is Pilot Pete. Who else? Oh, Mac Observer, of course.
Right. And Michael Johnston on Twitter is also, of course, Michael Johnston in real life. And he is the one that takes this podcast and converts it to AAC for us and for you. He's also the host of the We Have Communicators podcast that regularly features not only him, of course, but Jeff Gamet here of the Mac Observer and Adam Christensen of MacCast. And, of course, here at the Mac Observer, he's managing our back end so well. I don't know what we do without you, Adam. Fantastic. And I don't know what we do without you, Michael, because it's fantastic having you convert this show for us, too. We are surrounded by not only excellent talent, but excellent people. Cashfly.com provides all the bandwidth. The podcast marketplace includes the A2 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, Yojimbo from Barebone Software, PDF Pen from Smile, and Notebook from Circus Ponies, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. And John, I think that's it. We get to go. Hopefully, I'll be able to report from South by Southwest next week. Maybe we'll do this like Tuesday, Wednesday-ish after the interactive festival is over, and I can talk a little bit about that, and then we'll do Cool Stuff Found if we can make the technology.
Yep. Your call.
Cool. We'll have to test it before then, John, make sure it works. You know, we don't want to get in the middle of doing it, and then, you know, we don't want to get caught.